This episode of China Money Podcast is sponsored by Lehman Brown, a China accounting, audit, and advisory firm, Zuji.com, an online travel agent providing flights and hotels bookings worldwide, Mint.com, personal budgeting and financial management software, and GoToWebinar, unlimited webinars for one low rate. Go to ChinaMoneyNetwork.com and click on our sponsors' links. Thank you, everyone, so much. Welcome to China Money Podcast. I'm your host, Nina Xiang. Today's podcast will hear Oaktree Capital Group's chairman, Howard Marks. Oaktree Capital is, of course, the Los Angeles-based distressed debt investment firm founded by Howard Marks. Howard was a guest on our podcast last year. He talked to me about his views on China and Oaktree's operations in China. You can check out that podcast on our website, ChinaMoneyNetwork.com, by searching for Oaktree. For the past year, Oaktree has taken a few major steps in China. In September, the $80 billion under management Oaktree is among six global hedge fund managers being granted a QDLP quota, that is Qualified Domestic Limited Partners, allowing Oaktree to raise as much as $50 million worth of RMB in China and invest it abroad. Also in September, Oaktree closed a $700 million emerging market fund. And lately, you probably have heard, Oaktree signed a memorandum of understanding with China Cinda Asset Management to establish a 50-50 joint venture to invest in distressed assets in China. Oaktree is also one of the cornerstone investors of Cinda's Hong Kong IPO that is seeking to raise around $205 billion. Today, Howard Marks gave a talk at the Goldman Sachs Financial Services Conference on Tuesday, December the 10th in New York City. He talked about Oaktree's organic growth, where he sees attractive investment opportunities in distressed debt in today's markets, and how will the U.S. Fed tapering impact Oaktree's businesses. But before we listen to Howard, let me remind you that you can go to our website at ChinaMoneyNetwork.com to read about daily updated news of the latest from firms such as Legend Capital, Bahrain Private Equity Asia, and CITIC Capital. Also, check out our expert columns about the outlook of the offshore RMB market in 2014 and our business news on what's going to come for Chinese department stores and why is Chinese private equity outperforming its Asian peers. Of course, get the latest news with the Chinese economy and check out our China-related investment events listings and send us your firm's details to include in our China Alternative Investment Database. Lastly, if you enjoy our podcast, share it with a coworker, a friend, or share with your boss. We need your support to grow and to provide you with the best programs and content for free. Thank you so much, everyone. So here is Howard Marks. He responded to a question about how will the U.S. Federal Reserve's reduction of the quantitative easing programs impact Oaktree's businesses.
First, I'd like to commend you for asking about tapering without asking when it's going to happen, because this is the question I get most often, and the question I think has the least relevance. You know, if you thought it was going to rain tomorrow, you'd carry an umbrella and you wouldn't sit around saying, well, it's going to rain at 12 or 2, you know, and I think that's what people are doing with tapering. I don't think tapering is that big a deal, only in the sense that I'm convinced that it's probably going to happen. I think it should happen. I think that we need a free market in money in order for the free market to do its job of allocating resources, which it does so relatively well. And of course, we don't have a free market money now, so I hope we'll taper. And I don't think it's going to mean that much, because I think rates, in part, have already adjusted. You know, before Bernanke said what he said about tapering in May, I think the 10-year was at 1.5%, and now it's at 2.8. It went up to 3 and back up to 2.8. So I think that the world has had it. Chance to adjust to the idea. It's already acting in large part as if the tapering had started. The psychological impact has been there. And, you know, we can all sit around and say to ourselves, well, what would rates be today if the tapering weren't going on? What would be the natural rate of interest today? And I don't think that business is so strong or the demand for capital is that strong, and I don't think that inflation is that high, that the natural rate of interest today would be much higher than it is today. So, you know, maybe the 10-year would be between 3 and 4. I don't think it would be over 4. So what that suggests is that if they start tapering, rates will go up some, but not so much. The impact on Oaktree, it will not be great. First of all, you know, we're not what I would call a bond house or a traditional fixed income firm. We're a opportunistic credit investor, alternative credit. Interest rates are not the main determinant of value in the things that we traffic in. So number one. Number two, where we have bonds, and the main place is in high yield bonds, which is probably about 20% of our assets or a little more. They have a very moderate duration, between 4 and 5, I think. So the price doesn't change that much with a moderate change in interest rates. And then we have a lot of equity exposure, you know, in many of our portfolios where we buy debt. After restructuring, we convert it into equity. In many places, we buy equity. We do private equity, buy control of firms. We have some listed equity portfolios. So, you know, basically the traditional bondholder hates prosperity, because in prosperity, interest rates go up, and he loses money. Oaktree likes prosperity because the creditworthiness of our holdings goes up, the value of our equity-type holdings goes up. So it's not something that preoccupies us or something we're very concerned about.
Next, Howard explained, how has Oaktree been growing, and where is the firm headed?
I flatter us to think that other people are doing acquisitions so they can get like Oaktree. And you can decide whether you think that's true or not. I don't think we don't have to get like Oaktree. We're a lot like Oaktree already. And, you know, when we started in 95, we had 7 strategies. Today we probably have 20, I would guess. So we are highly diversified. We have diversified organically through what I call step outs, where you have a basic capability and you find an adjacent strategy that you can do with the people you have, largely, and in the areas you know. And so we've diversified into 20 strategies. By the way, sometimes people say, well, I want to stick to the basic strategies like distress. And I remind them that in 88, distress was a step out from our work in high yield and converts, which I started at Citi in 78. So, you know, we have grown steadily and organically through these step outs. We have not done many acquisitions. Our growth has been organic. And so the growth that you see us report, which has been steady and I think very at a good rate, has been kind of like, I think, of the retailer, same-store sales, you know. Growth through acquisitions doesn't mean anything if they're not in some way synergistic or it's, of course, you're always, you have the risk of not having a cultural fit. And so we think that our internal growth is much more meaningful and much more dependable. That if you look at the chart of our AUM, it looks like, it kind of goes up and then it has a hump and then it comes down. And then it goes up and again it has a hump and then it comes down. So it looks like it's variable, our AUM. The truth is that we have had, in the last two crises, we were well prepared with some of the largest funds we had ever raised. And then the finance guys gave us these crises, and we made a lot of money. So in 01, 02, we raised $3.5 billion. Historically, our funds had always been a billion or so. And we had a very high IRR, and we made $500 million of carry on that. In 07, 08, we raised $11 billion because we thought there was a crisis coming. It did come, and we've so far made $2 billion of carry on that. But if you strip away those two blips, I would call them, we have a very, very steady progression. I think the only year in which our AUM went down was 08 because of the markdown of values. Came right back in 09. Most of our investors were ahead from 12/31/07 to 12/31/09. They made money. But if you strip out the 01/02 funds and the 07/08 funds, you have a very straight progression. And then, so I think the way to think of us is a gradual, steady, but strong grower, 10, 11% a year growth on average. And then once in a while, we bolt on this, you know, kind of a bonus fund, which just gives us a lot of AUM. Our AUM growth, our fundraising has been very strong. We have exceeded our target on every fund we've raised since we, you know, in 98, I went into people's office. I said, we have four worst words in the world, the emerging market hedge fund. And so that 98 was the last time we were unable to raise what we wanted for a fund. But I'm very proud of the fact that prior to this year, we've raised roughly $10 billion or more of gross new money every year, 6 years in a row. And that includes 08, which was the crisis year, and I dare say that nobody else raised $10 billion in 08. We are well on the way to making 2013 the seventh year in a row of $10 billion or more of gross new money. But 13 is unique in the sense that many people probably here in the audience think that one of Oaktree's greatest strengths is the stress debt. 13 is the first year of the last seven in which we're accomplishing this $10 billion a year without a distressed debt fund. So I believe we'll accomplish that again this year with non-distress only. And we have a lot of funds, areas where we're raising money, including some very exciting new ones. Our institutional client, be it a U.S. pension fund or an endowment or something like that, needs about 8. The conservative ones have reduced their actuarial assumption to 7.5. So if you have treasuries that pay 1, 2, 3, high grades pay 4, stocks most people expect 6 or 7, how do you get to 8 on average? And the answer is you need alternatives. And, you know, those alternatives traditionally have been viewed as being hedge funds, which haven't given 8 or more in quite a while on average, private equity, real estate. But there's a real place that we've created in there for credit-based alternatives. And we believe that we can give people roughly 10% a year, probably net of fees, with low risk and high dependability and a big current component. And there's a lot of demand for that. We have created a suite of 5 products to do this over the last year and a quarter. And we've raised $5 billion for these products over that period, roughly, I think a little more. And none of these existed for us back at the time we went public. So we have $5 billion. I think we can raise a lot more in these areas. People like the idea, you know, sure, they don't mind the idea of getting 12 or 14 from private equity or real estate, but it's somewhat uncertain. And I think they very much like the idea of getting 10 through credit-based performing debt strategies. And that's what we've been doing. And this gives us a lot of runway.
Now, Howard is answering a question about, is he funding very few distressed debt opportunities in the marketplace today?
There absolutely is a paucity of bargain-priced distressed opportunities. Most of the distress which is out there is in just a few pockets. Shipping, power, non-prime real estate, and Europe. And there we find opportunities to put money away. However, even there, there's no deluge. And there are no forced sellers, and so there are no screaming bargains. And we're investing at a moderate clip. You know, we raised our Fund 9, I think it was at the end of 12, and we've been investing it, but gradually, for the reason that I described. And by the way, why is that the case? You know, economic recovery, low interest rates, accommodative capital markets, placid sellers, placid holders, is not a combination for bargains in the stress debt world. So we created Fund 9, $5 billion. We're investing it gradually. We did something rather unique in Fund 9, which is, you know, when you have a fund and you charge fees on the committed capital and only a small percentage of the capital is invested, you get a mismatch there and you get a real hit to the fund. And in the early years, you have a real fee drag. You know, if we were charging fees on $5 billion and had invested $1 billion, even if the fees are 1.6% and the $1 billion grows at 8%, the fund makes no money. So, you know, in order to avoid that effect, we have held off on initiating the investment period of Fund 9, and we're only charging on the invested capital, not the committed. We're making steady progress in investing it. One of these days, in the relatively near term, we will switch on the investment period of Fund 9, and that'll give us fees on the whole $8 billion committed capital at 1.6% or $80 million a year. But right now, we're going slow. Now, let me say that, you know, the great thing is, again, the finance gods restock the pond every cycle for us. And my last memo, which went out about 2 weeks ago, was called The Race Is On. It's a reference to a memo I put out in February 07 called The Race to the Bottom. And the race to the bottom talked about the fact that when people are in heat to put out money, there's an auction that takes place. Well, when you're in heat to buy a painting, you bid, the bids go really high, and art prices get in the newspapers. And the person who's willing to pay the most gets the painting. That is to say, the person who's willing to get the least for his money. It's the same in the finance world. And when people are highly motivated to put money to work, there's an auction that goes on. You know, and the price goes up, which is, for example, the P.E. ratio goes up on stocks. When the P.E. ratio goes up, that means I'll take less earnings per dollar of price. So the prices go up. The valuations go up. The yields go down on a bond. When the bond price goes up, it means I'll take a lower yield. I don't need 6. I'll take 5. No, somebody else says, I'll take 4. You say, I'll take 3. And that's the race to the bottom. But in addition to those factors, people say, I'll take more risk. So somebody says, we'll only make that loan if we get good covenants. Somebody says, I'll take light covenants. Somebody else says, I don't need any covenants. And that's the race to the bottom. So you get riskier deals, less safety, and inferior structures. So that's, you know, that was clearly one of the factors that brought on the crisis. That's what the memo in February 07 was about. And I put out a memo a couple weeks ago, The Race Is On, saying it's on again. It's happening again. And it's been going on for some little time now. And, again, you can make risky loans today. A risky borrower can borrow today and can borrow on easy terms. And what do they say on the car ads? Easy credit and low interest rates. And so I think it's extremely important to take cognizance of that and to include caution in your investing today. This is not a time for aggressiveness. You want to be aggressive when nobody's optimistic and everybody's panicked and they're selling regardless of price, even though prices are highly depressed. That's not the case today. So today is not a time for aggression.
This is Howard explaining, as a publicly listed firm, how does Oaktree manage the relationship between its LPs and its shareholders?
So, I don't know if you know the joke about the lawyer? The lawyer's accused that his dog bit somebody. So the lawyer responds to the lawsuit. He says, number one, my dog is tame and does not bite. Number two, my dog was chained up on the porch and the rope doesn't reach the street. Number three, my dog and I were out of town that day, and number four, I don't have a dog. So, you know, so the investment, what I, you know, the sense I get from the investment community is they say, number one, we don't give credit for carry. And number two, we don't like the fact that it's going down, which sounds to me contradictory. The truth of the matter is that when things get better, our assets appreciate, we accrue carry. We don't accrue it on our books. That we consider that to be an aggressive accounting treatment that we don't share in. we kind of have a notional. We accrue it on the books of our funds, because if we didn't, then the NAVs would be overstated. But we don't carry it onto our books because we think that that would be more aggressive than we want to be, and subject to reversal. If you accrue carry, you can have to de-accrue carry, as many firms did in 08. So we don't carry it on the books, but we certainly keep it, track of it. And we realized $1 billion of carry in the last 12 months. Much of it coming from from Fund 7B, which was our crisis fund. The interesting thing is, $992 million, I think, is what we realized in the last 12 months. We created 963 new. So we virtually replaced all the accrued carry that we realized. And we accrue carry in a large number of funds. How many funds did it? 20 funds or something like that. And so our carry is not in one fund. It's not in one strategy. It's well diversified. It has, and it's largely in credit-based assets. So we have a high likelihood of actually getting that carry one of these days. But we have to, each fund has to go through what we call a waterfall, in which first the clients get paid back their money, then they get paid their preferred return, and then we come in for first 80% of the carry until we've caught up with the profits they've already received, and then 20. So our creation of carry is somewhat lumpy, and our subsequent realization and receipt of carry is somewhat lumpy. The funds are on different schedules. The most important thing is that it's pretty remarkable. If you said Oaktree's going to wind down Fund 7B, what's going to happen to their accrued next-to-come carry? You would have thought it's going to go away, but it hasn't gone away. And the future is very bright. Now, if you ask the future in general, exactly when that carry is going to come out, I couldn't care, but the people whose dogs are chained on the porch shouldn't care either. The point is, we have just about a near-record amount of carry on the books of our funds, and it is going to come out in the intermediate-term future.
Lastly, Howard explains where he is finding attractive investment opportunities.
First of all, money has found it very easy to flow into public mainstream things. You know, if you can buy it in an ETF, it's probably up. You look at REITs, you know, for example. REITs appreciated very strongly some time ago and probably haven't been attractive for purchase for a while, in large part because they're so easily accessed through public ownership and ETFs. So I think that the best credit opportunities are in niche markets. I think that private debt is generally much more attractive than public debt today. I didn't mention mezzanine yet, but we have a mezzanine area. And today we're making mezzanine loans at roughly 11.5% yields, which is about double the yield on a high yield bond that we think is probably of comparable quality. So that's a pretty good example. Now with the mezz, it's a small deal. It's entirely illiquid. It requires a lot of due diligence. You can't put it in for it through an ETF. And the retail can't buy it and so forth. So mezz is an area. Europe is harder to access. Middle market, it's true. Mezz is middle market. We have a new area called strategic credits, which is kind of a spin-off from our distressed debt group. Used to be we had high-yield bonds that yielded 10 and distressed where we're trying to make 20 or more. Now high-yield yields 5 and distressed we're looking for 15. The clients, to get to this 8 average that I described before, they really need some 10s. So we have developed something called strategic credits to try to give them 10s. Things that the distressed debt group looks at and says, no, it can't produce 15. It can produce 10, 11, 12, but it's not so risky. And so we haven't had the bandwidth to turn to this to raise a fund yet, to market a fund. So what we've done is we've called our clients, the bigger ones, and said, would you like to open a separate account? And so far, we've opened 9 separate accounts aggregating $2 billion. So you can tell these are big accounts. They're all 9 digits. And And we're off to a very good start. The funds, the first year of performance in that area was excellent. And those are largely, you know, non-headline deals. They're the leftovers, the ignored, the have-nots. Real estate debt is another example, and we have a real estate debt, a real estate fund which we just completed raising, which came in well above our target, and where we had to actually go to the investors and ask permission to increase it some above the hard cap. And that invests in real estate properties, but also real estate debt where we think we can make 15 to 20 or so. And that's all buttoned up. But we're also raising a real estate debt fund, again, where we think we can make 10, 11, 12, maybe using a little bit of leverage, less than one turn. Not A buildings on Park Avenue or here in the financial center, but, you know, B and C buildings in non-prime cities. So the good news is there are lots of places, and of course in Europe, the banks, you know, are under restraints that they weren't under in the past. So somebody goes into the bank, they're doing we're doing a $100 million deal, and we have 20 to put in, we need 80. The bank used to give them 80, now they say we'll give you 50. They need somebody to give them the 30. So there's lots of niche opportunities, but not easily accessed. And these are the things we're doing now, and these are the things for which, as I say, we've raised $5 billion in new products since the IPO.
Great. That's today's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time.